Hello and welcome to the DTFF podcast. I'm Ash and I'm joined with two of the old fire buddies. We got Todd. And we got Scott. So as you can see, Scott is not with us. He's away training again. Going to be doing some of these remotely, but we're going to do our best to keep all three of us together as much as possible. This week, I think we're going to chat about some past training that we've helped set up, and then actually only one of us took part in. So we hosted for BC Wildfire the Engine Boss program locally here over the past weekend. We had numerous departments coming through, bush trucks, engines, water tankers, tenders, some task force leaders. And yeah, it was a one-day live event with some pre-read and classroom that was a prerequisite before doing it. We helped out get it set up, and then day of, passed it on to BC Wildfire. So, Scott, you were our main contact with them getting it set up, and then kind of what all came together and how we got it set up and ready to go.
Yeah, so as we said before, Engine Boss is the prerequisite course to boss engines during a wildfire. So basically to be a captain during wildfire. It's essentially, that's all it is. It's a captain's job. So what has to happen is there's a mandatory course run by the government. And if you're going to go on deployment, you have to have it. So we were asked to, we wanted to, but we were also asked to run the course. So there was actually a lot of prep to it, a lot more than we thought there was. We thought we basically just said, hey, these are the places, and so we're going to go. Of course, you can't just do that because you have to have, if there's the permission of people in the area to be able to go in and do some of the stuff we're going to do. So it took probably 3 or 4 days, even more, of going around. We had these letters made, and basically they're permission letters. There's a reminder letter, a permission letter. We'd go around and knock on doors, and a few of us, and just ask permission to do some of the things, like go into the backyard, spray some water, do some fire smarting. No hands-on fire smarting, but basically go around and like visually and verbally fire smart. So, hey, there's a wicker chair in front of this house. So we would move that to the front, put it in the jackpot, as we call it, when you put all the flammable material together. So we had to make sure there was permission granted from the homeowners, and the general neighborhood knew that we were coming. So there was lots of Facebook posts, lots of word of mouth. We had pretty good reception. A lot of the homeowners, they wanted us to even do more. Like, they wanted us to burn off material in their backyard to make it safe. And they wanted us to go the whole nine yards. Obviously, we can't do that for everybody. So we didn't do it for anybody. What we did is we just basically, there's a lot of imagination had to get used. Todd will talk about that in a little bit. But we went around. I think we only had a few people say no to us. And I know one of them for sure just didn't know what we were doing. And she literally thought, I think we were selling like diamonds from Africa or something. Like one of those, like, I'm a prince and I need $1 million to get my brother out of jail. Because she literally like closed the door on one of our guys' face. She's like, whatever you're selling, I'm not buying it, and closed it. He's like, I'm with the fire department. And she didn't care. So, once we got it rolling, Sunday morning we set up. And Saturday afternoon, we went around with the instructors, looked at the different areas that they really liked the plan we had. We ended up getting like, I want to say 50 or 60 homes permission in the three areas of responsibility. So they needed area of operation. They needed three areas of operation, at least, because there was a lot of apparatus there. So there was, I think there was 55 participants, and each apparatus held 3 to 4 members. So we had a lot of trucks in our parking lot and around the town. So there's a lot of action around town. Like, obviously we posted it, but still with that many apparatus, there's people just like, what is going on? Because, you know, there's a basketball tournament in town too, and there's like a marathon going on. So those people wouldn't know because they're not from here. So there's a lot of people like wondering what was going on.
Of course, yeah, it was a really busy town, weekend, yeah, right?
Yeah, of course, we're driving around town like code two with lights on only, because we didn't want to be blasting, you know, like 15 trucks with lights and sirens going. So just kind of lights only, as we would in a wildfire. We would, if we're in a wildfire zone, we don't like run code three all the time. We run basically code two, just, you know, running the old lights, no siren, and just letting people know we're there. So, but I think overall it worked out well. Todd's going to talk about what he saw from the course. We've all taken the course. Ash and I took the course. We took it in two different cities, so we both have different examples of Engine Boss. I took it in a bigger city. It was definitely interesting. Definitely a lot of new home construction we dealt with, and a lot of kind of tightly packed subdivision, whereas Ash was in a more rural setting, so I think he did a little bit more bigger stretches, longer things. So, yeah.
Did you guys only have the three areas of operations, or was there more as well? Because I only saw what our engine group did. I didn't see what the other engine group or the other Type 6 brush trucks did.
Yeah, we only had, they had actually asked for four, but we managed to get three because actually there was a little miscommunication. We thought they wanted something different. So we ended up with like five areas of operations. And then, but it didn't fit with what they actually wanted. So then we combined a couple. So we combined like an in-town one that was, I think that was a task force that was like a straight, like, I think it was engines and tenders, or sorry, engines and high and bush trucks. Then there was guys in the northern area, which was almost all, I think it was all bush trucks. And then your crew was a Sten group. So like a group of engines. So just the three.
Yeah, for, well, you figured there was 15 in total? Because we had five guys in our stand of engines. And then I know there's a few other engines that got diverted somewhere else. And then there had to have been at least another five brush trucks, if not more, including some of the forestry apparatus.
Yeah, I'd say at least 15. Because if you had 3 hours operation and then about five to six per, yeah, that'd be at least 15. Plus our apparatus, we had also had our duty truck and our chief were driving around. And our job was kind of, we didn't really have a job, but our job, as we saw it, was to kind of run interference, making sure everything was running smoothly, making sure if somebody that wasn't notified started freaking out, we would intercept them before they went after like someone from the course. We did have a little miscommunication on the hydrant usage, which is fine. I guess the one guy was a little upset with us using all the hydrants from that ran that section of the water. But luckily, he didn't yell. He wasn't upset with the actual participants from out of town. I don't know if he purposely found our truck and got a little unhappy with our guy from our truck, but in the end, it worked out.
Yeah, for my end, it was pretty good actually. If anybody hasn't taken this course, just a lot of the basics, just to really tie in a lot of the online component, some of your strategy and tactics. Try not to overthink things, and clear, short, concise communication is the other big takeaway. Because like everybody, we all have those guys in the departments that, well, I'm on scene, I'm parked by the bush, and this, and it goes on and on and on. We don't need that. Short and sweet. So that was really good. There's a few people in the groups that would definitely talk a little bit long-winded, but that got shut down pretty quick. So really, really short, concise conversations on the radio, and then a lot of safety, and not overthinking things. Like, prime example, a couple of spot fires were tasked on, and other trucks were tasked on. You know, we're pulling off our 200 length of forestry, inch and a half off the back, when realistically you might only need 100. So in our debrief, it was just discussed, you know what? You don't need to be humping out that 200 again. If it's only 100 feet away, you know, break your knuckle and just use that rather than re-racking another 200 feet. Because you got to think of speed, right? We want to re-rack very efficiently and fast and move and be ready to go on that next task. But it was good. We started out, we had our morning briefing at the hall here at staging. So we were Sten 1, so we had five Type 1 engines. And then we went out to kind of our safety zone north of the town, and we all just had a bumper talk and discussed, okay, what are some of the strategies and tactics? You know, this is how the day is going to look. Talked about re-racking, how our Sten leader wanted to see the trucks racked. So he prefers having two 200 foot lengths on the rear of the truck tied up, and then like 150 foot for the side pre-connect for your safety line for your truck. And just different options. He said, yeah, just fly at it, figure out how to re-rack it. We'll all go to each other's trucks and check everything out. We'll familiarize ourselves with each other's apparatus as well. Just as far as like, how do they get water? How are we going to feed them water? Because we may be looking at their truck and working very closely with it. So just a little bit of truck familiarization. A lot of good discussions took place there. And then we jumped into our first scenario. First scenario was basically, it was a pretty short and sweet. My engine company, we were tasked with water management. So we're going to stage at the entrance of the one subdivision. And if somebody needed water, our job was to go up and supply them with water. Also on that, we were a lookout and also for access and egress. So we kept that communication system going with everybody. Everybody else was doing their specific tactics. They had a couple of addresses that they had to go on task where the imaginary fire was coming from the east, pushing from the green up to the subdivision. A lot of spotting and ember transfers. And then there was a lot of shrubs that were on fire, so those guys were tasked with that. Another engine group was tasked with kind of patrolling, tactical patrols. And then one was one of the trucks, it was West Kelowna, was able to do pump and roll with their brand new engine. So they just rolled and increased the humidity to spray. As we talked about what that does with that humidity bubble and whatnot. And then basically, they were pretty short evolutions, actually. There wasn't a lot of water use. They just really wanted to get the guys take that hose off, spraying that water, making sure everything was actionable, re-racking with speed. Hey, I'm clear of this task, ready for the next. You get your next marching orders and move on. And then we talk about trigger points. Hit our trigger point, okay, and we've hit trigger point alpha, meaning that we all recruit back to or retreat back to our safety zone. And then we debrief. So that evolution went pretty well. We were fortunate actually enough to work with your engine as well, which is really good to see. Mostly actually our local departments. It had OK Falls, Oliver, us, Summerland, and West Kelowna in our group. So West Kelowna was the furthest away for us. But yeah, that evolution was good.
Nice, Todd. So when you talked about setting up the truck, so you've got your two 200 feet coming off the back, and then you have a protection line. So your protection line that's coming off the side, is that structural protection or is that forestry?
Well, strictly all forestry. So yeah, we had just a 50-foot length hung on the side of the truck, and we just used those seatbelt connectors, which were fantastic, and then two 200-foot sections of forestry, inch and a half, on the rear as well. So we didn't want to hang any forestry. We're basically direct to everything hanging is going to be a forestry rather than structure. And then if we need to do our anchor and hold, and then we're going to be all structure gear at that point.
Nice. So that was your guys' first evolution. Did you do two or three throughout the day?
So we did, what did we do? Four, five, something like that. So the next evolution was in the same subdivision. We got different tasks. This one was a bit more kind of the prep and go scenario. So we were tasked to go into the same subdivision. We had different areas and different addresses. So prep and go was simply go in. You know, I was actually running the truck at that point. So I just put her in the pump, let everything circulate. We didn't have to pull any hoses off at that time because it's non-defensible. You know, in theory, no safety zone. fire's coming in hot. So we're doing a little bit of strategically prepping if needed, or just assessments on some structures in case the fire front comes in. And then we only had 10 minutes until our trigger point. And then that 10-minute trigger point came. So we did a couple 360s on the houses, the address that we had. We talked about, okay, we have time to quickly jackpot these couch cushions that are on the patio. We identified some other areas around the structure that we didn't have time to clean up, but we flagged it, took a picture of it. And then basically, trigger point is here. Everybody retreat back to our safety zone. And then we would fall back out. And then the next move, of course, would be coming into that fire front following, possibly, if that was the same scenario.
Nice. Yeah. So
I guess
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. I guess a couple things, fire front following is as after the fire comes through, we come back in and we reassess. So they kind of go hand in hand with that. So basically it's a prep and go is, like Todd said, you quickly check. There's also what's called a check and go, which is literally like you knock on the door, no one answers, you leave. There's no prepping, there's no doing anything. It's like literally knock on the door, no one answers, you're out of there. That's even less of a time frame.
Yeah, that's right. And then our next evolution, we changed areas of operation. So we went out north to a larger subdivision. Still intermix. And this one was bump and run tactics. So, and this one was, a lot of ember transfers coming in. We're starting to see some spot fires around the structures. So everybody was split off to certain addresses where we had some positive IDs of some small fires starting from the embers. And we had one crew doing tactical patrols as well. So basically at that point, that was when we were flowing water. We'd get tasked with our address. We'd go do our 360, find the spots, action those spots, quickly re-rack, notify our Sten 1 leader that, task is complete, ready for the next. And then he'd redispatch us out to the next area of concern. And that one, again, we were probably only in there for 20 minutes. Tops doing it. Everybody was moving really quickly. We did 6 houses. We re-racked 2 times, and we're just prepping to refill when we're told to fall back to our areas of refuge. So our TRAs, we had 3 TRAs in that one. This is the temporary refuge area. So we retreated back to our TRA 2, it was called. And then, of course, when we arrived back, we notify our Sten leader, and every time we notify them when we're in a safety zone or a TRA, we give them a PAR update as well. So, and again, not the traditional fire ground PAR. Like, we're not saying, this is engine 19, or this is engine 191 attack team 1 with 4 on the alpha side, air 50 plus. We don't need that. This is simply engine 101's at TRA 2. Times 4, and knowing that we've got 4 members with us.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Everything that I recall from this course, if I think back to it, our first evolution, and there was 4 for us as well, it was basically everybody had to have a chance going through the truck. So we were in an engine as well. So you had to be the guy who drove, you had to be the engine boss, so the captain, and then you did 2 shifts in the back seat, being the firefighter. And I think the importance of that as well is to show that as the engine boss, you have an understanding of every role. So it's easy to be, the captain that doesn't get their hands dirty. It's easy to be the pump operator that doesn't step off the pump deck. But to quickly show that you can do every one of those tasks, you can drive safely and effectively, you can engage the pump and, deal with any little bit of issues that, come up. You may be coming off of a hydrant, you may be static water. There's lots of opportunity for different water supply. And then when it comes time to actually start flaking out hose, are you quick and are you effective? So when we did ours last year up in Grand Forks, our first rotation was super slow and shitty. Everybody around us was going real slow, didn't seem to be taking it very seriously. And like we were wrapped up our scenario probably in 10 minutes from the briefing. And we would radio like engine 101, like whatever our number was at the time, completed task, waiting for reassignment. And we got told, okay, like stay at your, you know, at your temporary refuge area and like wait for the rest of your team to finish. And we sat there waiting for quite a while. And then the next one went faster, and you can kind of see like the guys were starting to pick up on it more and like wanting to take it more serious and get that, you know, kind of realism down. Like, let's not like walk out here. Let's do everything with a purpose. And I think that's what they were really looking for, is like, they don't want to see you out there running, but they want to see fast and effective work. Cause we're operating in a pretty small area, which could not be all that unfamiliar on an interface type fire. If you're intermixed, you're definitely going to be spread out more. But if you're running in an interface area, your AO is going to be probably pretty small per task. Like, hey, this engine or this engine group or whatever you may be, this task force, you guys are this street, and go and deal with this street and then report back or whatever it might be. So going through all of these like bump and run tactics, your check and go, your prep and defend, all these tactics can be carried out quite quickly if you're operating in a smaller area. If you are in that, you know, larger scale intermix, that's when it starts to get spread out, and some of this stuff can take a little bit longer, and you kind of need a little more gray area with your operational timeline as well, because there's going to be time that is required to go from house to house, or maybe all you have is one given address, and then you need to be reassigned because it's such a large space, right? So kind of going through with what you have, what area that you're given. And like for us here locally, you guys were all like pretty confined to like quite tight areas, I would say, where one of our AOs, when we took ours, was like quite intermixed. It wasn't like next door is a stone's throw away. Like, you didn't want to walk from house to house, where our first two, our engine basically just kept leapfrogging. They would pull up ahead, park, engage the pump, and then we would walk from house to house. And then they would bump up ahead, stop, engage the pump. And all that was simulating was if something kicked off, they were ready to flow water. And I think that's something that's really important that BC Wildfire was looking for, is your truck was always ready to engage, even if you weren't flaking hose, right?
Yeah, 100%. And that was exactly discussed in one of the talks that we did as well. So when we were in a bit more of the interface subdivision, the houses were very close together. And same thing, it was just communication, and his tactic was, we're going to be leapfrogging each other as we go down through the subdivision. And that worked well. There was a point where one of the engines was tasked to transfer some water, and they ended up blocking the road. So that was discussed afterwards. It's like, no matter what you do, we're always keeping our egress open. You got to really remember that. So you got to remember that there's going to be apparatus possibly leapfrogging you, or else tactical patrol, somebody's going to be going around you. But even going back further, actually, I forgot to talk about in our debriefing we had when we kind of did our introductions. They kind of asked us, what's all on our apparatus? Obviously, the basics. How much water do you have? How much hose do you have? Hand tools, things like that. But also, what medic gear do you have? Do you have a full trauma kit with O2 and AED? Do you have any rope systems, like drop tanks? What do you got? So he's making his list so he knows who is what, who's pump and run capable. And we had a full medic kit and stuff. So, of course, we got tasked with being the medic in case there's an IWI, which is an incident within an incident, then we would be tasked to deal with that. So even though our primary goal is to be dealing with the fires, if there is another incident within that incident, whether it's an MVA or one of our trucks or one of our guys gets injured, we need to be self-sufficient and take care of each other as well. So that was discussed. And then everybody was aware of what each truck had on it. So it was really good. So we actually ended up doing four scenarios. So our one after that, we came back into the community, and this one was the anchor and hold tactic. So for this one was, we now have structures on fire, you know, so we discussed, okay, up to 25% of the structure, that's what we're going to be wanting to action. If it's over 25%, you know, that's when we need to decide, okay, we're stopping, we're moving on to the next to save the next. And it's very hard to make that decision when you're in that moment. For a lot of the people that have been deployed, they know exactly what that's about, especially this last couple of years, there's been a lot of structures lost. We've all been on those deployments where we've lost structures and it sucks. And the other big reminder was this one is the tactic is we're tying into a water source, whether it's hydranted or we've got a really good supply of tenders with us as well. And big water. So now we're structure firefighting, big water, and bunker gear. So bunker gear up, have your pack on. You know, the interfacility agreement states that you have to have your pack on with air. We had a really good conversation about that. That bottle, I'm saving that bottle. And this was the point of view from our instructor as well. He's going to save his bottle for when he needs it the most. If that wind shifts, if he's suddenly eating shit, that's when he's going to put that bottle on and sit there and fight this fire. But we're not going to be on air when we don't need it. And realistically, that's kind of how we train anyways. If I'm doing exterior ops on a structure fire, I'm not regging in unless I absolutely need it. If that smoke shifts and I'm eating it, then I'll put it in. But if not, I'm not wasting my air. So a lot of really good, just common sense tactics, just good discussions about that. And then different tactics. So the trucks that had deck guns, you know, are you in a position to deploy your deck gun? Is it going to be efficient? Is it going to be useful? And then 2.5s, what are you using? Do you want to bust out a ground monitor so you can leave it unmanned and maybe free up your guys on another hand line? Depends on the situation. So what we did for ours, we had a good hydrant right close to us. We were able to back up into a dead-end street. We just hand-bombed our 100-foot of supply line, connected the hydrant. Our guys started with the deck gun immediately, so we had a flow of water instantly while we're getting our bunker gear on. So that was perfect. And then I grabbed the 2.5 off the rear, took out just one length that we worked, and sat on the smoothbore. We're like, goddamn. And then we were just told to cut and run and wrap back to our safety area.
Nice. So one of the things that you brought up there was a bit of a talking point in our post-incident debrief once we were done up on our engine boss. So we all know the rule is 25%, right? So if a structure is on fire for 24%, you can go and try and extinguish it. 25%, yeah, you have to move on, right? So move on might not mean leave it alone. It just means you're not trying to actively extinguish that house for the sake of keeping it. So part of what we have to do is this house now going to be kicking off so much ember showers from being on fire that it's going to also start to spread onto the next door house or whatever it is. So yes, we might be actioning this fire and saying, hey, this is a loss, but I might not be saying stop all of your water supply to it. You might still leave somebody that's anchored to it with a deck gun that's just going to be, you know, laying the water to it in more of a, you know, a more defensible type situation. What you're not going to be doing is going in there structural firefighting a house that's 50% loss. You'll be, yes, structural firefighting, but everything's from the outside, from a next door defensible, like you're protecting exposures more than actually fighting the fire. On our sim, we got there and he's like, this house A is fully involved. House B is starting to get impinged with fire from house A. And the fire is now coming towards house C, A, B, C, D, E, F, all the way down the line. So, like, what is your priority here? And we had to look at it like, well, house A is a loss, house B. So we're not even going to start worrying about house A other than maybe trying to cool it. House B is what we're going to try to protect. And we're already setting up for house C and then beyond. But he says, like, are you going to be putting water on to house A? Well, yeah, that exterior side of the house that is impinging upon house B, like, that's going to be my priority. House B won't catch on fire if I can knock back the flames from house A. So that was kind of their test. Or, like, the rule is you don't put water on fire. Like, you don't, I don't want to say you don't put water on fire, but over 25% is a loss. Well, sure it is. But you can't ignore something that's about to be, like, cause more damage. So, like, there's things written in books, but then there's also reality. And that was something that was, you know, a little bit outside of what the book said. That was a really good talk, you know, a really good point to talk on once the course was done. And that was, like, that was my sim. And I was like, I want to see a 2.5 on the house that's, like, fully involved. And then I want to see hand lines because we didn't have a deck gun. We were first on scene. So I'm like, I want the 2.5 on the fully involved house. And then I want some hand lines coming off on house B. And then I cast some additional resources as they came in to protect the adjacent houses further down the road. So, and that was something that we got really high marks on from our TFL. Because they're like, we were wondering if you guys were going to completely ignore it. And if you did, you were going to lose the house next to it.
Yeah, I know you absolutely nailed it. And that's a great talking point, is because, you know, it's been proven that, you know, the biggest threat to the other houses and this spread is that ember shower and that radiant heat from that loss of that structure. It is so great that's put off of it. So we need to be reducing that by actioning it with water. And like you said, Ash, we're not putting it out, but we need to be slowing it down, just getting it a little black and to continue to until it's not as much of a threat with that ember storm. And that, yeah, that was exactly talked about in that scenario that we did as well. So that's a great point to bring up because it's, like you said, it's not as black and white in that 25% rule.
Well, a little bit kind of goes back to what we do now with our, well, we have a structure fire now in summer. We kind of flip the tactics. We fight the structure fire, but then we also send bush trucks out in the perimeter, look for spot fires. So it's kind of taking that wildland firefighting to the opposite way to being structural firefighters and then thinking wildland, because it could turn wildland shortly.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we have such a large intermix area here where, like, one side of the road is interface where it's like house to house to house, and the other side of the road, I mean, you could call it interface still, but the properties are much larger and they back onto a massive wildland area. So, like, with that gap between houses, I think that's such a good thing that, like, we as a group started to do over the past year or so. And I think just being more dialed in on the wildland side, just bringing some of that, like, tips and, you know, tricks and tactics back to the hall here. And yeah, I mean, skills are skills, and it doesn't matter what the scenario is. When you have that kind of grassland and that kind of, like, low fuel that could easily spread, especially once we get into, like, the hotter summer months, 100%, that works out really, really well. Getting people out on tactical patrol is super smart. And, you know, it's an opportunity for maybe some of your greener individuals that are just coming on to still be tied into the scene, have a job. They're not going to be out there structural firefighting, but they're still providing a huge safety factor, knowing that, you know, you're not going to get these spot fires coming up from a structure fire that had nothing to do with the grass fire, right? So,
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like, just having that mindset of what's working and what's not and what that next threat is, right? It's the same thing when we look at our box fire for structural firefighting on our normal day-to-day. You know, we always have that plan anyways, and this is just expanding it into the wildfire environment. And yeah, we actually talked about the pace as well, Scott, you know, just to bring awareness, because it's something that we all kind of do, like you've mentioned in past podcasts. It's just phrased a little bit differently, but we have that same contingency plan and stuff set up. So that was just another good discussion point that we talked about. And then one of the other questions was brought up was, well, what's our structured firefighting response? Well, it's strictly exterior ops. We're not set up for an interior. Somebody raised their hand and was like, well, what if it's just in the, it gets up into the soffits? We try our best. We'll give it our darnest, but that's it. We're not geared up and set up to do interior work. So therefore, this is an R1 structure fire we're dealing with our RIT teams and safeties and everything else. We are just doing our structure defense. So we'll still give it our best go until we have to stop.
Yeah, I think you kind of nailed it there. That was one of the things that we chatted about with ours as well. We, on our engine of four, sure, we could go make a quick push. But what do you have to have to make an interior attack? You have to have RIT. So it depends what kind of a group that you're operating in and what kind of water supply that you're about to have. And. So it's just a bit of a hard line that you just don't push in. If it was in our own local area in the first operating period, I think that might be a bit of a different scenario. But once we push out to a wildland type fire where we're working under BC Wildfire Services, it's such a larger picture. Like, you're going to do your best, but if it's up into the roof structure, if it's taken a good seat in that structure, you're kind of at that 25% anyway. You're not going to be able to do adequate water application from the outside and really stop it. So, yeah, as shitty as it is, it's just one of those things, right? You have to look big picture. And the amount of resources and time spent, once it's got that much of a foothold into a structure, you're probably beyond what you should be putting resources to anyway.
Absolutely.
I guess anything else on the engine boss course, Todd or Scott?
Not really for me. It was a great course. We had three really awesome instructors there. It's a great course. I think anybody who has any wildland issues near them should be taking it, because at some point you're going to be working with forestry. So just dust off those skills of the strategy and tactics and communication, and keep it simple, keep your head on the swivel, and move with purpose, right? Like, even in these training evolutions that we always talk about for practice nights, everything is trained with purpose, man. It was really good. It was a great course, and I know everybody was very appreciative of you guys hosting it and putting it on. That was discussed a lot as well, is just the legwork to start it, what you guys were mentioning, Scott, is getting out there, getting the waiver signed, communicating to the public. People aren't freaking out. We had everybody waving at us and thanking us, and somebody wanted to take a picture of us and thank us, and yeah, it was well received.
You know, I really liked was the fact that I think this is the first time I ever saw the forestry guys coming out in that role to do what they were doing. Usually they're like the actual forestry guys, because we had the task force leaders who are forestry guys, but there is actually like forestry trucks out there learning how to be engine bosses, which is definitely the first time that's ever happened, I think, at least that I've seen. Because usually the forestry guys are kind of doing their own thing. They don't really know what we're doing, but there's so much tie in now that we work together so well now. It's like, actually, it's very interesting to see, because it's a fairly new concept.
Yeah, and we've kind of mentioned this in the past, that over the past 5 years, 10 years starting, but over the past 5 years, the amount that we've seen BC Wildfire Services coming to the table on the structural protection side of life, on like the municipality fire departments being a part of this, has come leaps and bounds. I think their comfort level with what we bring to the table is getting better and better. They always have to play to like the safest, lowest common, denominator when it comes to these type of events, because they don't know. Like, it's one thing if we call for a mutual aid and Todd comes up with a crew. Like, I know what you guys bring to the table because I know you, and you're going to shoot me straight. But if I'm getting like even the next community over, I don't know them as well. Or the next community over, maybe I know the chief or a captain there. Now I don't know anybody. So I don't know what they bring. And that's kind of where BC Wildfire has to live. Like, you expect the worst, and then get surprised by what you get. And I can see every year that they're giving us a little more wiggle room. Like the gray area has gotten a lot larger where they're allowing us to like get out there and get after it and do our job because of all of these courses. They're doing their engine boss courses. They've got more TFL, the task force leader courses that they're putting on, and they're getting out in front of us, and we're showing them as a group what we bring to, you know, the table, as well as now we've had, like, we've been out on deployment for how many years, Todd, you guys are getting involved. A lot of our local departments are heavily involved in wildfire deployment, which is just adding again to like our interagency relationships, which is just allowing like this whole thing to grow. And it's way less clunky, I guess, is what I want to land on there.
Well, that again is, you know, the how this has changed. I was talking with one of the instructors there that I know from, he was a paramedic many years ago. Now he's a deputy chief. So we were chatting about that and the changes in municipal fire departments and the integration with BC Wildfire now, the past 10, 12 years has gone leaps and bounds. Like he said, like, I'm hardly in my department. I am doing this full time, working with forestry, teaching these courses. That's all these guys are doing. So it's changed tenfold.
Okay, beautiful. Well, I mean, we are a third of the way. I don't know what the date is. A quarter of the way through April? Third? Yeah, third. And April and then into May is going to be pretty wildfire-oriented for us for training. I don't know, Todd, what you guys are getting up to. But we've also got a task force sim that we're putting on, which is going to be the majority of our semi-local departments. Todd, you're coming up as a representative from BCEHS, which is going to be great. And then we're going to wrap up the month here with a wildfire sim of our own just for our local guys here. So lots of BC Wildfire-esque kind of training and tactics we're going to be discussing in the next coming few weeks. So something to look forward to. Definitely have a bit of a vibe going for the next little bit. All right. So I guess that's about it. Let's roll into some shout-outs. Todd, tell us a little bit about MODIS.
MODIS Fire Rescue, Claim to Fame, the Snagger Tool, and many, many more. They're fantastic. I was using their spanners. There you go, Scott. MODIS patch. I was using their spanners this weekend. And tourniquet pouch. Beautiful. Yeah, they make all sorts of stuff. So all your small appliances that they got. Yeah, their Lloyd tool. They've got some soft textiles now, the tourniquet holders. Some bags, some utility bags. Go ahead, Scott.
Lloyd Tool also makes a great hamburger flipper.
That is correct. That came off the pouch.
And I did it once.
when we didn't have one available. It was new still.
A couple times.
Yeah, and I also have used their battery wrench to stir my coffee. So multiple uses. But yeah, all jokes aside, they make a fantastic product. We really like a lot of their stuff. All their stuff. Actually, we've got a lot of it. We're rocking their gloves as well. They're a fantastic glove. They're on their website. We're trying. They are their radio straps as well. So hopefully at some point they're going to get those guys out in action for everybody. So you can check out them on their website and use GTFF5 to get 5% off your order.
Awesome. Stop the bleed.
Yeah, stop the bleed. Just saw my tourniquet pouch on my backpack. I have tourniquets everywhere. So the three methods of massive hemorrhage control are drug pressure, wound packing, and tourniquets. If you're going to have a tourniquet, have a good one. So if you want some training, check out stopthebleed.org.com. There's basically a stop the bleed in every country. So check it out in your local country because it'll tell you what you can and cannot teach. And there'll be courses you can take. And if you're going to do a simulation, do it high fidelity, just like we were talking earlier.
John, what are we sipping on?
Wolf Tree Coffee, a big supporter of them, and they are of us as well. So a local coffee company here in town, Wolf Tree Coffee. You can check them out online. Big fans of the Initial Attack blend, which we created with them. And the really awesome thing with that, again, is $2 of every pound sold goes to the Honor House Society. So the Honor House is a fantastic organization and honor ranch that helps all first responders and military. For a place of refuge if needed with their Honor House camp or Honor Ranch, rather, and Honor House down in the Lower Mainland if you need a place to stay, if you got a family member who's sick and in the hospital. So they're a fantastic organization. Wolf Tree Coffee was totally on board with creating that donation, and that blend is quite popular. So you go on their website, check out their blends, and if you want to buy one, buy the Initial Attack.
Awesome. Scott, wrap us up with Tanner Olson.
Yeah, Tanner Olson Band, country music out of Nashville / West Coast of Canada. They're touring, or they're doing live shows everywhere, basically down south. Hopefully they're going to be up here soon. Check them out on Spotify or wherever you get your music.
Awesome. Yeah, and then lastly, you have us. You've obviously found this wherever you're listening to this on, so hopefully on a podcast platform. We do upload every podcast to YouTube as well as training videos. We keep trickling out there. We probably put out more training videos in the past month and a half than we did in the past year and a half, so that is a direction that we're moving now. We definitely want to get more hands-on tools, more boots on the ground. Nothing crazy, things that you've seen or likely have the ability to see 1,000 ways over, but we love doing it. You guys love seeing it. So that's what our focus is going to be. So we're on the YouTube, big focus there, but we're also sharing that stuff out on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. I think that's it. We're not on X, nor are we on LinkedIn. So we'll, put all of our focus there. We got a great team that's helping us out there. We're going to start looking into some interviews coming up. I assume once we get through the next busy couple of months with training, seminar, Scott traveling. So sometime on the later portion of summer, we'll start maybe booking some interviews. Todd, any more for anyone?
Nope. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.
Scott?
Nope. Good night.
Awesome. Thanks again for listening. As always, stay safe. Stay DTFF.